there's no doubt, like much in our society, the food landscape will be forever altered. But I really do believe that this moment is teaching us how important, how essential everyone along the food chain is to our society. So those along the margins of the food system, the farm workers, the grocery store clerks, the small farmers, the producers, the food insecure, the people who up until this moment were largely invisible, that the coronavirus has sort of brought to light, right? So in this very short time, the pandemic has sort of upended our world and obviously, you know, the lives of millions of people. And so for many people, this moment is teaching us just how important, really how essential everyone is along the food chain to our society.
It's time for conversations about our food and how it's grown on Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.
Whether you are in the midst of a world-changing pandemic or just interested in the evolving food landscape from Capitol Hill to Main Street, the reporting found in Civil Eats should be on your list. The founder of Civil Eats, Naomi Starkman, joins this episode of Farm to Table Talk to share the servings from the virtual food news buffet that is Civil Eats. But first, this episode of Farm to Table Talk is brought to you by the Tomato Products Wellness Council. Now more than ever, tomato farmers and processors are proud to be there for the American public. The canned and jarred tomato products they grow are healthy, affordable, and picked at the peak of flavor and nutrition, and sealed within hours so that all year long you can enjoy the taste of summertime. As we've learned in these hard times, these pantry staples have been lifesavers for those in need, thanks to the growers who are still farming and to the tomato products industry. For more farmer stories, nutrition information, and recipes, visit tomatowellness.com. We don't hear about restaurant food buffets much these days, in part because some of us overconsume. Well, these days, I don't think we can overeat the offerings of a food news buffet like the one offered by Civil Eats. In this episode of Farm to Table Talk, we're talking to the founder and editor-in-chief of Civil Eats, Naomi Starkman. Naomi, I've been looking forward to having you back for Farm to Table Talk, and you're here. How are you doing?
I'm fine. Thank you, Roger. Thank you for asking me back. It's nice to speak with you.
Naomi, when I think of Civil Eats, quite a few metaphors occur to me, and especially your role. You're talking about the food system, and you've got stories about what's happening all over the world, certainly all over the country, and all different kinds of things. And I was, on the one hand, I was thinking, with all this stuff that's going on, especially in the times through the coronavirus, my first metaphor was I saw you in sort of like a lookout tower on top of a mountain, and you know, and you can look across the horizon and look at the valley and see things developing and share them with the people that are seeing your reports or seeing what you're tweeting or going onto your website with a broad spectrum. And then on the other metaphor, which I can't really put these two things together, is I think of Civil Eats as almost a buffet, that there are so many delicious dishes that you can help yourself to. And that's where I ended, and it was time to call you. So I'm not sure if either one of those metaphors strike your fancy, or you can create a new one.
I appreciate both. I mean, I think they're both really good and they're apt. I mean, I do think that Civil Eats is somewhat like a sentinel. You know, we are on guard to stand and keep watch over the food system. And we've been doing that now for 11 years. And it is like a buffet in the sense that we cover so many different issues that impact the food system. And so we feel really uniquely qualified in this very moment to talk about the issues that the coronavirus has sort of brought to light, right? So in this very short time, the pandemic has sort of upended our world and obviously, you know, the lives of millions of people. And so for us, this is not news, but for many people, this moment is teaching us just how important, really how essential everyone is along the food chain to our society.
It's really interesting. And you know, when you look at these perspectives, whether you're up on a hill looking at it, or this is a buffet and you've got all these dishes that represent the stories, there are a lot of interesting things that are encouraging. It's hard to describe how much activity is out there. I mean, I have this sense that in the last couple months, it just seems like there's more momentum, and really a lot of it is ultimately positive momentum. It just seems like it's forcing more progress to take place. It just seems like everywhere you look, there's something interesting going on, and maybe encouraging in the long run. What do you think?
I think it's right. I mean, I think, you know, as journalists, you might be this way too, Roger. I always think of myself as a short-term pessimist, but a long-term optimist. You know, the situation we're facing in the United States in our food system is due to long-simmering problems that have to do with consolidation and big markets that up until now felt really efficient, but are really showing themselves to be quite brittle. So you look at these supply chain and distribution channels, and these are things that, of course, you and I for a long time thought were really important, but seemed really dry or uninteresting to most people. Now the average person is reading and seeing a lot of headlines about farmers dumping milk or having to plow under potatoes, and seeing on one side of the food system this kind of massive supply, and then on the other side of the food system, hungry people, and scratching their heads and asking, well, what's going on? I think one of the exciting things, and you point to this, is about the opportunities and some of the brighter news that, you know, maybe isn't being as reported as often, but we certainly have been following, and that is that now more than ever, small businesses certainly are at risk, but they're also more nimble, and they're, you know, they're able to shift and pivot to newer, different markets, and there's a lot of community support, and it will probably end up making them more resilient. So we've been reporting on that, and we've been seeing it across the food system in seafood and regional grain sheds and farmers pivoting to online markets, and then the rise in community-supported agriculture. So you see these headlines that the food system is breaking, you know, or that we have a shortage of meat or, you know, Trump's Defense Production Act order. But the truth is there are a lot of players. You know, the food system is a very broad system, and there are very different systems at hand. And so while this massive, inefficient system, which we thought was efficient, is really breaking down, we have this very resilient local system at hand. And that's where there is some positive possibility. And there's no doubt, like much in our society, the food landscape will be forever altered. But I really do believe that this moment is teaching us how important, how essential everyone along the food chain is to our society. So those along the margins of the food system, the farm workers, the grocery store clerks, the small farmers, the producers, the food insecure, the people who up until this moment were largely invisible and who many in the nation now recognize as indispensable.
You know, when you say that, the other side of this that I think of, the ones that are feeling really having challenges, are say for the people that were geared up to produce sometimes large scale production for, say, the restaurant, the food service industry, which restaurants almost went away. And so if you're a dairy farmer producing cheese and the whole system was geared to massive production of cheese and schools being out, leads to the dumping of the milk because there's no way for them to kind of pull back. And even I'm finding farmers all over the country, and I know you cover this too, that are working with restaurants and starting to produce food for all sorts of things like, you know, seniors and at-risk people and students that are out of school. And they've got themselves all reorganized so that the farmers are hooking up with some local restaurants and they're getting some help to be able to produce food and supply that locally too.
Right. And you're seeing a lot of very innovative, smart, nimble farmers who are able to pivot, you know, as I mentioned, to online markets. And as you mentioned, you know, so many small farmers, sell bulk of their produce to restaurants. And so with those markets now closed, food service, you know, restaurants, institutions now closed, you know, they've had to be very quick to create new markets. And it's challenging. right? Some don't sell to farmers markets. They sold to restaurants, schools, communal places, and those markets are now, you know, being shocked. So growers have had to scramble to move their sales online, but they have done it in these very innovative ways that are also full circle in our society. As you mentioned, to support food banks, we just did a story about how in Vermont, this huge community effort came together to take surplus milk from Vermont dairy farmers and process it and deliver it to Vermont food banks. And that's a private-public partnership in Vermont. So there are these bright spots where we see some very innovative community actions in the face and lack of federal support.
Well, and then also the processing businesses, smaller and more nimble, are running into or having opportunities, I guess. And I think you've covered some of that as well, whereas there's been a lot of publicity about the large meatpacking plants that employ several thousand people. And when they get hit with coronavirus, there are, millions of hogs that aren't able to be processed. And some of those are being euthanized, they are saying, because they can't go through any other kind of channels. And yet, one thing I know you've covered over the years, too, is the need for more nimble local processing, even for these meat processors. And they seem to be, they're finding a way to stay very busy, and it's probably easier for them to have safety with their workers because of, you know, the distance. They're not clammed in, they're not going quite as fast, and that's a surprising area that really hasn't been on the radar screen for most of us.
Right, and I mean, it's an interesting point, and if you kind of scope out again and you look at the numbers, I mean, today around four companies slaughter between 80 to 85% of the nation's beef. So 50 plants process something like 98% of all the meat in our country. And that consolidation has made meat cheaper. And yes, it's a more efficient system, but it's led to situations in which farmers raising meat for example, a Smithfield plant in Sioux Falls, Iowa, you know, where they're contracted to take their pigs when they reach slaughter weight, you know, suddenly had nowhere to go because the pandemic forced that plant to close. And so there are all these much smaller and much more nimble regional slaughterhouses. And so, but the problem is that this consolidation has led to the closure of all these small slaughterhouses. And so the story you're referring to is about, you know, how at this moment, small meat processors, it's really their moment to shine, but it really points to the lack of infrastructure and the need for investment. Again, it's the totally unsexy stuff in the food system that for a long time, people just didn't want to pay attention to, and which for me personally, as somebody who cares very much about systems, I kept pointing to was the infrastructure that's so needed. So we have all these really hardworking farmers and ranchers who want to participate. And on the other side of the table, we have eaters who want to support them. But we need to give them the means to produce, process, and distribute our food in a meaningful way, right? So all the things like transportation, refrigeration, distribution, the things that make markets available for small to medium farmers is so essential. And I think right now, if there's any golden light ahead at the tunnel, it's that hopefully these regional food sheds, these regional food systems will get that kind of investment to withstand further future food shocks.
Naomi, I wonder, too, if they're going to have more friendly regulations in most of these states, because some states, California is one of them, they made it so difficult to have meat processing take place locally. I know for lambs, I think there are two places in the state of California. You know, we've got 40 million people and the coast is 1,000 miles long. And there's only, I think, two spots that lambs can be processed. And around the country, I've heard similar stories. So hopefully some of these state assemblies will take another look and say, look, I think we might have gone a little too hard trying to tighten up on these. We should try to make sure the regulations are encouraging safety, but it's not something that's just impossible to run these businesses.
Well, and that's right. And there is a potential federal policy fix to help bridge this gap between slaughterhouse supply and demand, and it's called the PRIME Act. And this legislation would change regulations to allow farmers processing animals at custom plants to sell their meat, but it has some limitations, and it would potentially shift some of the processing burden off USDA inspected facilities and provide growers with more options nearby. It just was resurfaced by Representative Shelley Pingree from Maine just a week or two ago. And she sent it to House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, you know, urging its passage. And so these regulations would very much address what you're talking about, which is to support producers, give them the ability to process their meat in a way that's community appropriate.
So when you see these things that are popping up, they're encouraging, and you hear about legislation like this, how far can you go in promoting activity by your readers, by the people that are following Civil Eats?
Well, you know, as a journalistic outlet, we strive very much to not get involved in the business of advocacy. So our job really is to inform, educate, hopefully inspire people to action. And the job of action is really, kind of not our work, but our work is to really say, here are the facts, inform yourself, and then get involved in some way or another. So we never take a lobbying position. We don't advocate. We're very careful in that regard. But hopefully our information is helpful and useful for people who do want to further take action. I mean, if you read any of our stories, you'll see we have dozens and dozens of links in the stories so that if you, as an active consumer, want to take part in some way, you can further follow up and then follow the organizations who can help you be a more involved and active and activated citizen.
Here's one of the other things that seems to be happening are hubs. Food hubs have been around for a while, but it just, again, it seems like it's kicked into high gear. Farmers that weren't formally involved in hubs, you're talking about people that three or four farmers are getting together, or 10 or 15 or 100 in different spots, to figuring out how they can promote their product online or work up a delivery system of food. Isn't it amazing, Naomi, how these things are just popping up all over the country, but there's not really a national program. You know, it's to see things that just almost spontaneously evolve like this is, I find it amazing and kind of a miracle that it happens. And no doubt you're contributing to it.
Well, I'd like to say we've definitely contributed to the conversation. I mean, food hubs are basically the physical brick and mortar space where a lot of this, you know, aggregation distribution takes place. And they have been surprisingly successful at overcoming considerable financial challenges to become viable businesses that will support small and mid-sized sustainable growers and help to get healthy, fresh food into different communities. So they've been an incredibly important part of the infrastructure in rebuilding regional food economies, especially those that have been degraded by industrial agriculture. There's some really good models across the country. We've written extensively about food hubs. And I think that is the kind of nut of this moment of what does it look like? How do we actually help? Because I think, you know, over the years, there's something like 350 or more active food hubs in the United States compared to about 50 just about 20 years ago. And so that sort of looking at the success rate of food hubs, what it takes, it's challenging. And they also have to weather, you know, our current economic reality. That's going to be really very much, I think, the future is looking at how these places, these spaces can come together and not only just, you know, help farmers feed their community, but address all of the issues you spoke of at the beginning of our conversation. So can they be receptacles or locations for feeding the hungry, for the elderly, for those who are undocumented, people who are at higher risk of not only for coronavirus, but also for hunger. And that's going to be very essential as we sort of weather this new economic reality.
From where you see it, is there much change taking place in the community gardens?
Yeah, we just did a story actually about school gardens, and we're doing another one about community gardens. I mean, I think school gardens and community gardens as well have just had to, like many businesses and operations and organizations, shift very quickly. And so, for example, many school gardens, you know, right away shifted to feeding their communities. And this is the remarkable thing about some of these small nonprofit organizations doing this good work. They see the need in their community and they're able to very quickly shift. And, you know, there's, as you know, because I'm sure you've been seeing the headlines and your listeners have as well, is this tremendous interest in growing your own and this notion that there's this resurgence or rebirth of victory gardens. We've written about this extensively as well. And, you know, this notion of food sovereignty, of being in control of our food supply, I think is very appealing to individuals right now because they're seeing all of the breaks in the food system. And so reducing the many hands in the along the food chain has been very appealing to people. So whether you're buying directly from your farmer, supporting a farmer at a farmer's market, or through a community-supported agriculture program, or you're growing your own, I think these ideas about bringing your food system closer into more individual circles has been definitely on the forefront of many people's minds these days.
You know, I hear that it's almost impossible to get some young chicks, that there's such a demand for people that would like to get chicks to have some chickens that they could raise themselves and produce at least enough eggs for their family, let alone possibly they can sell them to others as well. And I've heard others say some small goats and people that are on the fringe of other spaces outside a city, that they're looking at animals that they could be able to graze as well. And again, it just seems all over the country. You've got people that are contributing to Civil Eats all over the country. I know you have somebody in North Carolina, you're in California, you've got people that are contributing all over. Don't you notice that it's sometimes surprising the things that they're coming up with, that they're seeing from where they are, and that it just almost seems like the environment is creating this spontaneous creativity. They're getting ideas from you and they're looking at it, but then what they end up doing is their own variation. I mean, what happens in North Carolina is not just copying what happened in California. They're finding their own way that just works for them.
Well, I've always said that, you know, it doesn't really matter who's in office at the sort of head of leadership in our country when it comes to food systems, because from where I sit, I really do believe that there are so many incredible stories of people and projects and places that together are these sort of thousand lights, bright lights of building a new food economy. So yes, I mean, I think every individual and every project and every place in this country, it's all very specific to their country, to their counties, to their communities. And I think that will be eventually what I think will save us. Like, I get asked a lot, for example, you know, what's the one policy you wish we could see on a federal level that would change everything? And the truth is we have such deep inequities in our society, from structural racism to, you know, terribly bloated agriculture policy, that I really think that at the end of the day, the things that will make the most difference in communities are community involvement. Of course, we need very deep changes at the federal level to address many of these inequalities. But I do think these individuals are inspiring because they're working in their communities and addressing their own issues with their own people. And that has a kind of depth and power to it, and longevity to it, that I think communities really need in order to grow and survive.
You know, in a couple minutes, I want you to kind of summarize the waterfront that you cover. There's another metaphor for us, but that all these different kind of topics and hit kind of highlights to make sure we're not leaving anything out. But you cover such a broad range of exciting developments. But one question I have for you right now is that, pick out a story that's made you feel especially good lately, that somebody that you've got it published or it's in the works, And you said, wow, now that is good. I'm glad we're able to share this.
Gosh, it would be like picking one of your children.
I know. Some sort of a Sophie's choice here. I thought that, I shouldn't have asked it that way, but I'm still going to ask that. You can pick out more than one, but just give me a couple that are really making you feel good.
I'll tell you that... I'll tell you a range of stories because I think they're all very different. I mean, one in particular that we did very early on was reporting on how coronavirus is creating a food security crisis in Indian country. So looking at sort of the ways in which coronavirus is devastating indigenous communities because they've really long been shut out of food supply chains and infrastructure development. And we did that over a month ago. Now a month later, the Navajo Nation has surpassed New York and New Jersey for the highest per capita coronavirus infection rate in the United States. So I think one of the things we do uniquely is, you know, being ahead of the curve and identifying things and writing about them first. So that story was a conversation that I and our managing editor, Matt Wieland, had with some individuals from First Nations Development Institute and the work that they're doing to try to bring food to their communities. And that's a story that we is very important. And then kind of in the midway, I would say we did a story on how important gardening is, but that seed saving is really crucial. And it was kind of an introduction to a new video series we're doing on our site. It's very, there's a very beautiful video that component to that, and I'm very proud of that. I worked actually with my sister, who's a filmmaker, and we're going to be doing a number of videos for Civil Eats. So you should take a look at that as well. It's a beautiful story about the importance of seed saving, especially in this time. There's been all this panic planting, but there's also like seed and plant hoarding. So we talk a little bit about those issues. And then I think, I really think that some of the other stories that are just about workers, I mean, all the workers along the food chain, from farm workers to food service workers. We did a story today on undocumented workers, on grocery store workers, migrant farm workers. I mean, just the workers in our food system and really putting a face on labor issues in the food system. Those stories, you know, and our writers are so incredibly talented and devoted and committed to covering these issues. I'm very, very grateful for their reporting. So I would say, you know, any of our stories about labor have been really important and I especially value.
You get into that space quite a bit, don't you?
We do. And we are going to be, today's story was about undocumented workers and how they lack access to channels to support them. And they're being very hard hit by coronavirus, both just infections, but also just because of restaurant closures. But we also did a story early on about grocery store workers and how they originally had received what's called hazard pay, which isn't actually very much money. And in some cases, it's only an extra $2 an hour. We'll do another kind of follow-up story about what's happening to workers. And so while there are some workers, and many whom you have met are grateful to be working, and many don't want to be working, and they feel very stressed about being on the front lines. Like, they didn't sign up to be a hero. They signed up to, you know, don't have a choice, in other words. We also have a system in this country where most farm workers are guest workers from Mexico who are brought here under the H-2A visa program. So, yes. You know, it's a very different system of how people are paid. And then we had, you know, early on the coronavirus, there were some leaked reports that the administration wanted to decrease farm worker pay. At this very moment where they were deemed essential, there was a discussion of reducing, you know, how much farm workers make. And so I think, you know, we have always devalued the work of farm workers. I myself have farmed, and it's certainly the hardest work I have ever done. And many of these farm workers travel and live together in very close conditions, and they don't and can't socially distance themselves. And yeah. We don't actually know how many farm workers, for example, have contracted coronavirus, but there are several COVID hotspots that have come to light. And again, it just reveals how our agricultural system really can expose workers' lives to not only to coronavirus, but makes them really at risk. And so I think finding workers is an extreme challenge. I think we're seeing actually in other countries, in Germany, I've seen lots of reports, international reporting on trying to find people to farm. We've always had that problem in this country. It'll be interesting to see what happens with farm workers as if, in fact, farm workers continue to get sick, what we do in this country. You know, this is the high season right now for farm workers. And in a lot of places, you know, in Monterey County, for example, which, you know, is known as America's Salad Bowl, health officials have reported dozens of farm workers being infected. So when you look at what we rely on and who we rely on in this country, I think we really need to put them as put priority on giving safe social distancing and health and worker conditions to these laborers if we want to continue to have the food that we've had in the past.
Well, I think it's really important, the stories that you share. And in fact, I end up having similar interviews on my podcast because I'm interested and I want to, in a small way, try to be able to contribute as well. Remind people that are listening to this, because I think if people listen to Farm to Table Talk, if they're not already following all that you're putting out on Civil Eats, they should be. So tell people where they can find your work.
Sure. It's civileats.com. We have a subscription service, so you can read 5 stories for free every month. And then if you want to read more, we ask that you join us as a member. But we've also, given that the coronavirus is creating such economic hardship for so many people, we've actually created a much more flexible sliding scale so people can join at any amount that they can. We don't want to limit people from being able to read our content, especially now. We really appreciate the support.
Well, and if you look at your advisors, you've got kind of the who's who of the food movement that are advisors to Civil Eats. Are they giving you suggestions?
Not specifically, but we do follow a lot of their work, and you know, many of them are very active. So, for example, Top Chef Tom Colicchio has been very involved in helping independent restaurants. You know, some of our advisors have written for us as well. Mas Masumoto just wrote a really beautiful op-ed about the hands that feed us. Marian Nestle's been really involved in writing about different aspects of the food system impacted by coronavirus. So Ricardo Salvador as well has been kind of a light for many people, because many of these issues for so long he's been writing about and talking about specifically as it relates to race and food. And he wrote a really great piece actually quite recently talking about systemic racism and the food system and how COVID is really not just a food crisis, but it's really showing and sort of shining a light on all of these issues that for so long he has written and talked about. So we have some really great thinkers and actors on our advisory board, and we're very grateful for their support as well.
Now I've got the conversation coming up with Marian Nestle sometime in this next couple of weeks. And Ricardo's story that you're talking about, I think it was in the New York Times, was it not, or am I?
No, this is actually in another publication called FAIR. It's Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. But Michael Pollan wrote a really great piece, which is called The Sickness of Our Food Supply, which is the New York Review of Books. And then Eric Schlosser wrote a really good piece about food workers as well for The Atlantic. So, I mean, I think you're seeing some of these luminaries really coming out at this moment to add their voice to these conversations.
Well, I'm looking forward to checking them all out. I did read the Ricardo's piece, and I thought it was really comprehensive and impressive. What I'm left with is, as when I put my reader hat on and I'm just listening to these things and reading them, I think, but what am I to do? And I wonder if that's not often a reaction from people that are seeing what Civil Eats is putting out there, is that there is so much going on. And even though you're not into advocacy, I would think that many of the people that are reading and listening are have in mind, well, I want to do something about it. I mean, they can vote with their fork in a way, you know, what they choose to eat and support, I suppose. But even though you avoid advocacy, any other suggestions you have for those people that are care enough to be engaged and follow up what's happening, of what are the kinds of things they can do if they want to help keep this movement going?
I think the most important thing people can do is really support local farmers and keep their dollars in their local economy. Know where their food is coming from. Ask your farmer important questions. Understand the true cost of food. And just remain curious and remain informed.
Well, that's good advice. Naomi Sarkman, I'm really happy you've been on Farm to Table Talk. We need to come back and do this again, and you do great work. Keep it up.
Thank you so much for having me again, Roger, and best of luck, and take the best of care.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.